The section-leading Knock Boys basketball team starts the second half of conference play coming up this Tuesday night, and WISR is there. Hi, everyone. This is Scott Briggs inviting you to join me as the Knock Knights, number one in Section 1, will take on the Mount Pleasant Vikings in Saxonburg Tuesday. We'll be on the air at 7:15 with a tip-off at 7:30. Knock basketball presented here on WISR by Hefford Tillotson agent Mike McKee, by Butler County District Attorney Rich Goldinger, by the Butler Health System's Faster Care, by Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, by the law firm of Dylan McCandless, King, Coulter & Graham, by Troy Allen Chevrolet in Slippery Rock and Troy Allen Buick in Katanning, and by the John W. Thrower Cement Corporation of Saxonburg. It's Knock and Mount Pleasant Tuesday night, 7:15 airtime, 7:30 tip, right here on WISR, WISR680.com, and the Trib Live High School Sports Network. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us. Nice to have some sunshine and warmer temperatures. It's 24 degrees out there. Feels like a heat wave, doesn't it, after this morning? 4 below zero here in the city of Butler. We had readings of 8, 9, 10 below in some outlying areas. Just brutal. Looking at about 30 this afternoon and mid-40s tomorrow. Who would believe it? Rain tomorrow, though. Hey, we have a good program today. A little bit later on the show, we're going to be talking with a Pennsylvania State Game Warden. I think they go by officially a different name now. But we'll be chatting with Chip Brunst, who's an information and education specialist, talking about the Game Wardens. I'm interested to talk to him. That's coming up a little bit later on the program. First, though, we're going to be chatting in just a couple of minutes with an author from Germany. In fact, we'll be talking to him in Berlin by telephone. His name is Daniel Schönflug, and he's written a marvelous book about the end of World War One. You know, we just marked the centenary of that a couple of months ago. World War One ended in 1918. There were a lot of activities around Veterans Day this past November, marking the 100th anniversary. Well, it was that period right after the Great War that was filled with hope, with disappointment, with remorse, and that's what Daniel Schönflug has written about. It's a good book. So we'll take a quick break here, and as I said, we're going to be making connections with Berlin, Germany, to talk with Mr. Schönflug, and we'll talk with him in just a couple of minutes here on It's Your Turn on WISR. Be right back.
Did you buy a car, truck, or SUV last year thinking you were going to get 0% or some other low-rate finance offer and then drove off the lot with a much higher rate? Don't worry. Armco Credit Union has the solution. Refinance with us and get a 60-month loan on a 2016 or newer vehicle for just 2.24% APR. We've got low rates on older models, too. It's never been easier to join, so call any of our four branch locations today or visit us at armcocu.com for membership and rate information. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is federally insured by NCUA.
In the new year, make a resolution to be better informed. Bookmark papost.org and make it part of your daily reading. While you're at it, subscribe to The Context so you'll receive a curated list of important stories in your inbox every day. You can be confident that the reporting you receive from PA Post is trustworthy because PA Post is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization whose first priority is to report on Pennsylvania policies and issues, holding those in power accountable. Jump in at papost.org.
Fascinating interview coming up, listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest is author Daniel Schönflug, author of A World on Edge. Sir, nice to meet you. It's terrific to talk with you here today.
It's great that you have me. Thanks so much.
The end of World War One that came in 1918. We recently celebrated the 100th anniversary of the end of that great war. And as you talk about in your book, it was not only the end of the war, it was the dawn of a new age. There was great remorse, of course, at the loss of life, but there was great hope, was there not, sir?
Yes. So some people call 1918 the beginning of the 20th century, and I think that is for a reason. As you said, it was the end of a war. It was also the end of a world order as four big world empires crumbled and broke down. But at the same time, this breakdown opened so many new opportunities. On the one hand, political opportunities with, you know, the Russian Revolution and many, many new states and regimes and ideas coming up. But then also new social ideas about equality, solidarity, emancipation. Finally, also artistic ideas. I mean, it is a moment of the avant-garde with surrealism coming up, also Dada, the composition with 12 separate tones. On so many levels, the world was newly invented in 1918, and that's why I speak of comet years when I speak of these years in German.
Our guest listeners, Daniel Schoenflug, is an internationally recognized historian. He's at the Free University in Berlin. He's lectured, by the way, at Harvard, at the University of London, at the Sorbonne, and he's also been the author of numerous docudramas and a consultant on radio and television. I understand, sir, that this is your first book in English. Is that correct?
Well, I have a collection of essays that came out some years ago on gender history, but this is my first monography, and it's a wonderful experience. The biggest privilege, actually, for an author is to be translated and read in other languages, and then to discuss with people all around the world about things that are dear to your heart.
I have read that the seeds of World War II were actually sown in the peace treaty that ended World War I. Would you agree with that, sir, and could you elaborate?
So there is some truth to that. But the first thing that I want to say is that my book actually tries to see that moment not only from the perspective of what happens later, because this is often a closed our eyes to this particular, this utopian moment of 1918. If we only see it as the gloomy times when World War II and National Socialism emerge, we're missing something. This being said, you're absolutely right. I mean, the end of the First World War was a moment when the world could have looked for a new equilibrium, for a long-lasting peace that would settle some of the conflicts that had led into World War I. And the problem was that somehow many of the actors of the time were not ready for that. It is clear that this war that had cost so many lives and that was so destructive on so many levels was not really a good moment to sit together and to think how the world could be a better place. I mean, the American president of the time, Woodrow Wilson, he went into the negotiations with very idealistic ideas. He really thought that peace and democracy should be the principles for a new age worldwide. He was dreaming of a League of Nations that would help to settle conflicts in the future. But his ideas were not really heard back then, and national interests, imperial interests somehow were stronger. And that somehow set the stage for new conflicts, new frictions that would then unfortunately lead into World War II.
We're talking with Daniel Schoenflug, author of A World on Edge, The End of the Great War, World War I, and the Dawn of a New Age. You talk in your book about the reaction by any number of famous individuals once World War I ended, one of whom was Virginia Woolf, who I guess was questioning whether or not it was all worth it, right?
she was very, very pessimistic. And, I mean, you would imagine that by the end of World War One, almost everybody was enthusiastic just about the fact that the war was over, that there was peace, and that normal life would come back. But Virginia Woolf somehow was not so enthusiastic. She thought that the celebrations and all the ceremonies by the end of World War One that happened in Great Britain, especially in London, were very disappointing. Somehow she felt that her government and the country did not find the right way to celebrate, and that these festivities only brought out the disappointing truth that the British, in her mind, didn't really know what they were fighting for. I mean, they often spoke of it as a war of liberty against despotism, but somehow she wasn't able to see it that way, and she wasn't convinced that that this kind of freedom that the government was speaking about was really worth so many deaths.
Harry S. Truman was running a men's store, a haberdashery in Kansas City, Missouri. Had no idea that he was about to go bankrupt, and of course, decades later, would be president of the United States. Were there any reactions from him that you were aware of, Daniel?
Well, that's really an amazing story, because Truman is an artillery officer in World War One, quite successful, because he managed to bring his company through the war without losing a single man, and he was certainly proud of that. On the other hand, he was disappointed because when he was a young man, he really dreamt of becoming a war hero, and that was not exactly the case. He made a decent career, but for him, the war could have gone on in order to rise him to greater heights. He had a dream by the end of World War I, a very personal one. He wanted to get married to his wife, Bess Welles, to his future wife, Bess Welles, and then take back the farm that his parents had, and become a farmer and live a peaceful life ever after. Then coming back, the conditions for farming were not so good, so the farm was sold, and he started the haberdashery that you've already been talking about. And then the post-war economic crisis set in, which ruined his young business, and confronted him with the large debt that he took years and years to pay off. So his dreams at that time were not so much political or social or artistic. He had his own very private dream of, you know, private happiness with his wife and probably children. And he also dreamt, and that he writes in letters to Bess Welles, that he wanted to, after that war, to never fire a single shot in his entire life. This is a dream that, as you know, did not come true, because Truman was the president who ordered the atomic bomb and the end of World War II. So that's one example of many that shows that even though the post-war of World War I was really an era of hopes and dreams, and a huge opening, but that by far not all of these dreams did become true.
I knew that Harry Truman had run a men's store in Kansas City. I did not know, however, that he was a captain in the U.S. Army in World War One. That's interesting. We'll take a quick break. We want to talk a little bit longer with Daniel Schoenflug about A World on Edge. And we'll pick up our conversation with him here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after this break.
Curious about the world around you? From politics and gardening to unlocking the secrets of longevity, Experience Mind Matters, a free series created especially for baby boomers and beyond. Mind Matters is a series for older adults to watch, learn about new things, and then engage with their peers. Contact your local senior center for more information. To locate your nearest center, visit aging.pa.gov. Again, that's aging.pa.gov.
The doctors and staff at Applewood Chiropractic are hosting a Natural Solutions Hemp Oil Extract informational event Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. Mike Gallagher, a certified lifestyle educator and consultant, will discuss hemp extract oil, how it works, what forms are best, what to look out for, and how it correlates to pain, brain, and inflammation. You do not have to be an Applewood chiropractic patient to attend. Space is limited. Call 724-283-8894. Applewood Chiropractic Health and Fitness Center, Thornapple Drive, Butler.
They have spent a lifetime caring for others, and now the time has come for others to care for them. LifeSteps Adult Day Health Services, a trusted provider of senior care for over 30 years, can help. Families are comforted knowing their loved one will be safe, receive meals, be medically monitored, and enjoy socialization, all designed to enhance their life in a comfortable, relaxed setting. Free trial visits. Call LifeSteps today at 724-283-1010 or visit lifesteps.net.
Welcome back. My name is Dave Malarkey. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR Radio. We're chatting with guest Daniel Schoenflug about his book, A World on Edge, The End of the Great War, World War I, and the Dawn of a New Age, 1918, 100 years ago. We just recently celebrated the centenary of the end of World War I. I'd like to talk about another dreamer, Daniel, a man's name that we would come to know here in the U.S. decades later, Ho Chi Minh. At the end of World War I, I had no idea this was the case. He was a dishwasher in Paris. Are you kidding me? Was he already dreaming about liberating Vietnam at that time?
Well, he started to. It's a very interesting time. So he left Vietnam, his home country, working on boats and ships. He was working for the kitchen, doing really hard labor. Then he ended up in London and later in Paris. As you said, washing dishes in hotel restaurants. Then he started a little business as a photographer. That was in Paris too. And then he actually started to, through his readings, to become politicized and to be drawn into the politics of that time. And actually, in 1919, so when the negotiations for the peace in Paris actually started, he got very excited hearing the American president Woodrow Wilson say that in the peace negotiations, the colonial people should have their say and that they should be asked about their particular wishes for the future of their respective countries. And so he felt entitled to unite with other Vietnamese in Paris and to set up a kind of petition or a letter of requests that they have against the French colonial power. And then he seems to have bought himself, or borrowed rather, a suit and a tie, and he went to Versailles, to the very palace where the peace negotiations took place, and he tried to see Woodrow Wilson and other representatives of colonial powers in order to present him and these others with a petition. And as you can imagine, he was not even admitted to the offices of these people. He was maybe able to leave a few copies of the petition before the police discovered him and carried him out of the palace. But that was clearly the beginning of a political career that would then lead him to Moscow, and from Moscow to China. And as he was moving on, his communist convictions would become stronger and stronger. And when he returned a lot later, in the 30s, to his home country of Vietnam, he would become the leader Ho Chi Minh that history would know, and he would lead his country into independence from the French.
Yes, we had what was known back then as French Indochina. Vietnam was one of the colonies of France at that time. Fascinating to think that if the Allies, the victorious Allies at Versailles, they were preparing for the to sign the Treaty of Versailles to end World War I, if they had listened to Ho Chi Minh, we may well have avoided the Vietnam War decades later, huh? Wow.
That's certainly an option. I mean, history is not about what could have happened, but yes, I mean, it, as I said, it's a moment of opportunity. Same is true for India. Gandhi is one of the characters in the story, and the Indian National Congress is actually deciding to send a delegation to the peace negotiations in Versailles, and they choose a comrade of theirs, who's already in London, to go there, just that the British will not allow him to cross the channel. And so he never makes it to Versailles. And instead, there's an official Indian delegation that is all put together by the British colonial government. So there are many opportunities in that moment, also for the Middle East. If you think of Syria today, if you think Eastern Europe, Ukraine, so many of the structures that are very, very significant and often problematic today are created in 1918, and this shows how many options there were, and that not all the decisions taken back then were the best ones.
Yes, Britain not only still controlled India at that time, but parts of the Middle East, right? And this would have been the age of T.E. Lawrence, right? Lawrence of Arabia?
Exactly. So he's one of the characters in the book, too, and we see him at the moment of his greatest victory, when he enters Damascus at the head of this very, very successful Arab rising. And in that, at that point, there's still a unity between this Arab rising and the British army, both together united to fight the Ottoman Empire and the Germans. But as soon as the war is over, this dream of the Arab uprising, which is basically the foundation of independent Arabic states, is very quickly shattered. Somehow the promises that helped to mobilize the Arabs did not hold in the post-war era. And so very quickly in the peace negotiations in which Lawrence of Arabia participates to some extent, show that the Arab cause is not really at the core of the hearts and minds of those who are negotiating. Actually, what we see in Versailles is that France and Britain are thinking of ways to share in the control of the Middle East, and there's a new, political device that helps them to do it, which is the so-called mandate system. It's part of the League of Nations plan, and the idea is to govern certain regions of the world, such as the Middle East, through mandates that are given to the former colonial power. It's a way, in fact, of continuing colonial rule without calling it such.
Yes, and in fact, some of the borders of countries, present-day Iraq, for example, as I understand it, were drawn by the British, perhaps setting the stage for, again, future conflicts decades later, right?
Absolutely. The whole region is the borders in this region are first defined for the 20th century in that conflict. That also applies to to Israel, which is, of course, founded a lot later. But the post-war settlement also allows for the first for the continuation of settlements of Jewish settlements in Palestine, and that will be the root, of course, for the foundation of Israel. And that is another structural decision right after World War One that will lead to a long legacy of conflict.
Yes, the Palestinian mandate. What about refugees, displaced people? There were millions of them, right, after World War One. What happened to them, like from the Czechs and Arabs and so on and so forth?
Yeah, so you have to imagine that this war mobilized millions of men and a few women, too. And that meant that many of them were really far from home, fighting on fronts that they had never seen before. I mean, we know that the British mobilized Indians, for example, and Pakistanis. The French mobilized soldiers from their African colonies. And for some of them, it took a long time before they could go back home. And one of the stories that I'm telling in the book is of a female Russian soldier. Her name is Marina Yolova. She's one of the few women who served in the First World War as soldiers, not as, as nurses or in other functions. And she, as a Cossack, followed her father into the war. Then, when the Russian Revolution took place, she was wounded and spent some time in hospital. And then she finds herself on the side of the white, so of the enemies of the Russian Revolution, fighting the revolution. But basically, what she does is not really fighting, but is fleeing from the overwhelming force of the enemy. And what she does is she was one of the last soldiers who manages to get to jump on one of the last trains of the Trans-Siberian Railway, taking her all the way through Siberia to the Pacific coast of Russia, to Vladivostok, from where she can take a boat to Japan, and finally from Japan to the United States, where she actually spends the rest of her life. And this young lady who starts out as a soldier will then begin a very successful career as a dancer.
Wow. You also talk about the invention of the remembrance poppy in your book, A World on Edge. Can you talk about that for a moment or so, Dan?
Yeah, so the symbol that is so familiar to all of us was actually born right before the 11th of November, 1918. And the lady who had this amazing idea was a university professor by the name of Moina Michael. She was from Georgia, but at that time she served in New York in the YMCA. She would actually prepare young people for support missions for the European war. And in 1918, in November, she read that famous a poem to In Flanders Fields the Poppies Bloom, and that inspired her to write her own poem about the war death and about the poppies. And then it inspired her to think of the poppy symbol as a way of showing solidarity with the soldiers and later with the veterans. So she goes into the department stores in New York in order to find artificial flowers, artificial poppy flowers. In the beginning, she has quite a hard time, but then she manages to find some. I think it's 25 in the beginning. She wears them on her jacket and gives them to some of her colleagues and men, too. And in the beginning, it's just a way of expressing solidarity and of showing how strong the home front still is. But in the months to come, she's going to turn this first idea into a real campaign, a campaign that is destined to raise money for the veterans of the war, for the wounded, for those who need treatment, and also for those families, widows left behind, the orphaned children that all needed support so badly. And in a few years, this idea took off. Not only in the United States, but also in Great Britain and the entire English-speaking world, and even in France. And very soon, millions of dollars were raised every year with the poppy symbol, and it became really a huge success that goes on until today. Only Moina Michael is somehow forgotten.
One final question as our time begins to run short here. As you mentioned, Daniel Schoenflug, the world was suspended between disappointment and enthusiasm 100 years ago at the end of World War One. Why do you think the Great Peace failed to come to fruition, or is that too complex an answer to summarize?
So, if I speak of the moment of 1918 as a utopian moment, that means on the one hand, all these wonderful things that we still believe in today, I mean, peace, freedom, emancipation, equality, and solidarity. On the other hand, the utopian moment also included some movements that were really, really destructive. We cannot say that the communist movement on the one side and the fascist movements on the other side were not utopian in their own way. They were utopian too, and they showed that the like an overstretched utopian impulse could be very, very destructive, very violent. And it's actually the clash of these radical utopias that led from one war to the other. And it's very tragic that the seed of something very powerful and even beautiful then led to something so terrible.
You are talking to us from Berlin, sir, is that correct? Are you in Germany today?
Yes, I'm calling from Germany.
Wonderful.
From Berlin.
Gosh, it sounds like you're in the next room. We have a great connection.
Well, we're lucky.
The title of the book, folks, for our historians or for the general public, this is a great read. The title is A World on Edge, The End of the Great War and the Dawn of a New Age, by our guest for the last few minutes here on It's Your Turn, Daniel Schoenflug. Thank you, sir. Nice to talk with you today. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave. It was great to talk to you.
Same here. So long now.
Choices, decisions, quality health care. These are important issues that really hit home. It's a good thing that Concordia Visiting Nurses is here to help. Home health care can help you or your loved one recuperate from an illness, manage a chronic disease, or recover from an injury or operation right in your own home. If you're in need of home health care, choose Concordia Visiting Nurses. Call toll-free at 1-877-352-6200.
Need to get out of town? Check into Butler Motor Tours. They can get you out of town in style and in comfort on their big luxury cruise buses. Have you checked out their website lately? So many exciting trips coming up. Check out butlerbus.com and find out where they're taking you next. They have trips all over the country. They'll even help you set sail to maybe the Caribbean. Casino trips, historic landmarks, all across the country. No driving, no handling luggage, entertainment, and most meals. All can be put together with no worries, all in an inclusive price. Call Butler Motor Tours today for more information. Or again, go to their website, butlerbus.com, and check out all of the exciting trips. They especially take care of you around the holidays. Seriously, no better way to travel than Butler Motor Tours.
Welcome back, friends. Boy, fascinating discussion there with Daniel Schoenflug. Wow, it's amazing to talk to someone who's in Berlin, you know, and as I said to him there at the end of our conversation, sounds like he's in the next room. Well, our next guest is not only in the next room, he's right here in the studio with us. He's Chip Brunst. He's an information and education specialist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission. Chip, it's nice to have you here today. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
We want to get a little bit of general information. I want to learn a little bit more about game wardens and who they are and what they do. And I suppose the first thing we should do is straighten out the name, because Chip came in and sat down and I said, well, it's not game warden, is it? It's WCO. And you said, well, actually, it isn't WCO anymore, huh?
That's correct. We are game wardens now. Began January of 2018, our agency changed our titles to game warden.
Well, so, now, originally they were game protectors, right?
Correct. It was game protector from the infancy up until 1987 when they changed it to wildlife conservation officer.
Mm-hmm.
And then just recently to game warden.
A lot of people still refer to these individuals as game wardens, and I suppose that was okay.
Yes.
Wildlife conservation officer is a little bit of a mouthful, you know?
Yes. Throughout my career, whenever I'd say wildlife conservation officer and I'd get the quizzical look on their face, I would say the proverbial game warden. So we're used to it.
Well, you know, I thought it would be great to talk to you, and I really appreciate you coming in today.
It's my pleasure.
We have a lot of hunters around here, and even people who don't hunt or aren't particularly active in the outdoors, they're watching a lot of TV shows. There's one called Northwoods Law. Have you seen that?
I have, yes.
I find it fascinating. It's game wardens. It's mainly New Hampshire and Maine, I think. At least those are the only episodes that I've seen.
Yes, it started in Maine and then moved on to New Hampshire. Pennsylvania was one of the states that was considered for that back when the show started also, but that did not happen, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And of all the shows that are on, the Maine game wardens are probably the ones that resemble the Pennsylvania's agency the most.
I've noticed a similarity. I've watched it for quite a while now, a couple of years anyway, since I first discovered it. I did see in the New Hampshire people, they also have some waterways territory. They'll go out and check whether people are, you know, catching the wrong kind of lobster or something like that every once in a while.
Right.
You don't do that in Pennsylvania, do you?
We have reciprocal responsibilities with our sister agency, the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, where we may work with them. But we are the only state left in the nation that have two separate agencies, one for fish, one for game. So I deal with the fur and the feathers, and they deal with the fish and the slimy critters.
Nice way to put it. I just remember, I think within the past month or two, doing a news story here at WISR, where they were about to welcome a new class of individuals to become game wardens. Am I remembering that correctly, or am I going goofy on myself
here? Actually, yeah, you are correct. We have, it's a twofold announcement. We have a class of game wardens in our academy right now, and they will be graduating here later on in February, coming out to the field and helping some much-needed field officers right now that are working very hard to keep up with things. And then the flip side of that is the agency just announced that we're going to put on another class, which they'll start accepting applications on January 28th. And you do that through the State Civil Service Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
that must have been the story that I read back over the holidays sometime, yeah.
Right, yep. Yep, Game Commission to recruit new game warden class.
Now, I'm familiar with the State Police Academy. It's in Hershey. I do not know where the Game Warden Academy is.
That's a good question. Game Warden Academy, first class in, it was founded in 1932, first class in 1936. And that was, at the time, in Brockway, Pennsylvania, not too far from here.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the late 80s, they built a new facility, a brand new facility, which was a state headquarters in Harrisburg. It's on Elmerton Avenue. And along with that, they put a training wing in that. So the training academy, the classroom, the chow hall, their day room, so to speak, that's their TV room, and their barracks located upstairs along with the gymnasium is all right there on facilities with most of the instructors that are located there in Harrisburg.
Now, you're an information and education specialist. Did you have to go through the academy as well, Chip?
I did, yes. All game wardens and land managers have to go through that before they can become a game warden.
And did you go to the newer place in Harrisburg?
I did. I was a member of the 21st class. The 20th class, the one prior to me, was the very first class to go through that facility. And now we're going to be starting our 32nd class. All told, there's only like right about 1,000 people that have ever graduated from this academy.
Wow. Yeah. How long do you have to go to school?
It is 51 weeks long.
Yep. It's a year.
Yeah, yep. It's a year. It's paramilitary. They get up in the morning. They do their PT, their physical therapy or physical training, and then they go in, take their showers, do their chores, so to speak, then report to 7 o'clock to eat breakfast. 7 to 8 is a breakfast time. 8 o'clock to noon is in the classroom. And a one-hour break once again to take for a meal and clean up any chores that they may not have completed in the morning. And then 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, they're back in the classroom again. And it's very, very tight schedule. They have a lot to get crammed into that short time frame.
And you live in barracks?
And they live in, it's more like a college dorm room atmosphere.
Okay.
But yeah, there's 3 to 4 people per room, though. Mm. Yeah, so.
Is it hard to get in? Are there prerequisites and requirements and all that sort of thing?
Yes. It is difficult to get into. They're going to, on this class here, they're going to test 1,000 people for the class. Or there was a certain date that was announced, that being until February 23rd. They'll keep the announcement open until February 23rd until they receive 1,000 applications. And then that starts the testing process. They will first take a written test, which is done through the State Civil Service Commission. They'll take the highest, and the number always varies, but they'll take the highest, like 10%, 15% on to the next step, which is an oral test, in which case the applicant will be interviewed in front of a camera, and it'll be recorded. These DVDs then will be sent off for evaluation to be tested. Well, that, at that point, then
that'd be nerve-wracking, wouldn't it?
It would, yeah. And you do have live people. It's just similar to this right here. You have live people standing there talking to you,
yeah.
But it's recorded, and then it's sent off later for evaluation.
Wow.
And then those two scores, your written and your oral test, are combined together to give you a 100-point score. And it usually takes a score of 92 or 93 or higher to get into the class.
So it's not too easy to get admitted to the Game Warden Academy.
It's not. Usually there's 25 to 30. I think they're looking to get 35 or 36 lined up for this next class.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any choice? We're talking for listeners who may have joined us a little bit late, and that happens, especially during this hour, people getting in the car, getting out of the car. We're talking with Chip Brunst. He's an information and education specialist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission. He is a game warden, and we're learning a little bit. I am. Hope you are, too, listeners, about being a game warden, and we'll talk about what they do in just a moment or so. Do you have any say in where you get assigned after you successfully complete your training at the academy, and I assume there's a graduation ceremony and so on and so forth? Do you have any say whatsoever where you're assigned, or
you really have no say in it, but you do have an input in that they ask you for your input. Where would you like to go? They'll give you a list of available districts,
mm-hmm.
And those are in different counties, and then they will pick based on how they feel you would fit that district. So if they don't want to send a city grown up person to a farming community,
Ty Nester or somewhere like that.
Right, yes. Yeah, so they're going to try to match you. Even though that person may want to go to Ty Nester, they're probably going to go to Pittsburgh.
I would imagine a lot of people, would prefer to be close to where they grew up, I suppose.
That is historical with Pennsylvanians. We like to come back home.
Mm-hmm.
And true to nature, our agency does that and has realized that here probably about the time my class graduated, that it was better to send people back close to home, and it actually saved the agency money in the long run with somebody not transferring then 2 or 3 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So I was assigned here to Butler County back in 1992 and never left. I just went into the regional office just last year, and that's the first time I ever went anywhere. So I'd spent almost 27 years here in Butler County.
Are you from this area originally, Chip?
I am not. From Titusville area. I went to Titusville High School.
Well, that's not too far away.
No, that was about as close as I could hope to get.
Yeah. Yep. It's up in Colonel Edwin Drake territory, right?
That's correct.
I've talked with several of the state park managers, and it's kind of the same thing. They don't have final say, but once you get a little bit of a seniority, they can request assignments, hopefully closer to home or closer
right.
to where they want to be.
Yeah, their system works a little bit different than ours because where they're assigned to parks, their rangers can move from park to park,
mm-hmm.
whereas Butler County, there's two officers here. There's a northern and a southern, and the gentleman that took my place in northern Butler County, he waited for 8 years for me to leave, and had I not received the promotion that I did, he would have been waiting another 6 years before he would have been able to come home. This was his home area also. He was from mm-hmm. Prospect.
Are your headquarters still here in this area, or you work out of Harrisburg now?
I work in Franklin now.
Okay. Yeah, there is an office there, isn't there?
That's correct. The Game Commission state headquarters is in Harrisburg, and then we have six different regions, northwest, southwest, north central, and so forth. And the northwest region, which I'm assigned to work in up in Franklin, covers 10 counties, this 10-county little sixth of the state over here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I drive to Franklin every day to go to work.
I have not hunted in many, many years. When I was a youth, I hunted for a while.
Well, we'll have to work on recruiting you again.
Well, and my brothers was a much more avid hunter than I. But I get confused by the new designations of different hunting areas. I'll get news releases from the Game Commission, and they're talking about this area and that area, and maybe it's just me. My eyes glaze over. It seems like it's so complex.
Things do seem complex, but many years ago, they went away from the system of mainly people were used to buying a Butler County doe license.
Yeah, county by county. That's right. The way it used to be. Yep. When I hunted, that's the way it was.
Right. Now they went to wildlife management units.
That's what I couldn't think of the term. Yeah. Wildlife management unit.
Right. So the hunter's out in the middle of the woods, and he's got a Butler County hunting or doe license, and he crosses over. You know, he hasn't crossed the road, but he's crossed over into Armstrong County by a half mile. Is he legal? Would he have been legal to shoot that doe in Butler or in Armstrong County? Well, no, but that was hard for this person to decide what county they were in. These wildlife management units now have geographical boundaries, not political boundaries, so they are divided up by roads, highways, and rivers that separate these things. So there is easy distinguishment between management units. So for us right here, Route 8, Northern Butler County, all the way down to Route 228, Route 8 splits Butler County in half, and you have 1A on one side and 2D on the other side.
Eastern half, western half.
Correct, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Some counties are lucky. They don't have any divisions, but there's very few of that.
Now, if you buy a hunting license, that's good anywhere in the state, right?
Yes, your general hunting license is good for all of the state of Pennsylvania. That includes small game hunting. Will include a fall turkey tag, a spring turkey tag, one spring turkey tag, and an antlerless deer tag. An antlered deer tag. So you can shoot a buck with that. And then if you want to shoot doe, you have to apply to the county treasurers to get an antlerless license or a doe license.
And they're still limited, are they not?
Yes, they set the numbers, which the commission meeting is coming up, starting on this coming Sunday, and the biologists will propose the numbers to the commissioners, what they want for each one of the different wildlife management units, and then the commissioners will have 90 days to decide that for sure, and then at the April commission meeting, they will make final decision on, yep, it should be this, or we need to drop it a little bit, but it's all based on political science, or based on biological science.
So depending on where you wanted to hunt doe or antlerless deer, you would have to get a license in that particular wildlife management unit, because if you crossed the road into another one, it would be, I mean, it'll be allowed at all, or maybe
that's
much
correct. Now most of our management units are right now set up to where the first 5 days, Monday through Friday, it's buck only, and then starting on the very first Saturday of the regular rifle deer season, it goes to buck and doe, so you'd have to have a doe license.
Yeah, that's something else I remember from when I was a youth. There was we used buck and doe. It was buck season.
Right.
And it was doe season. Doe season is very short.
Yes, it used to be 3 days.
Yeah, mostly. Compared to buck season, which is 2 weeks, I think, the regular one.
Yes, yep. Buck season had always traditionally been a two-week season. It always starts the Monday after Thanksgiving and ran until the two Saturdays. You got two Saturdays in it, and then on the next Monday after that, you had 3 days of doe season, in which case then you still needed a doe license. And there was a time where if you shot a buck, and even though you had a doe license, you didn't have a doe license anymore if you shot a buck.
You were done.
You probably remember those days, but this young man sitting here may not remember those.
We'll take a break. We're learning about game wardens, a little bit about them. We'll talk a little bit about what they do when we come back, chatting with Chip Brunst and with us here in the studio today on It's Your Turn. One of our sponsors on the program today is Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. How convenient is this? When you have to ship something out, an article, instead of having to hunt around for the right size box, that one's too big, this one's too little, where's the bubble wrap, where are the peanuts, where are the mailing labels, just take your stuff to Gone Postal Butler, just off Newcastle Road behind King's and Villa Grande Restaurant. They'll package it up and ship it any way you want, by the way. You want to send it to U.S. Postal Service, that's fine. UPS, that's fine. FedEx, that's fine. They'll do it. Very affordable, very convenient, very fast, too. I've utilized their services. Works great. They also offer copying service. They do scanning, faxing. You can rent a temporary mailbox there. And there's even an official notary. They're open Monday through Friday. Call them for more info, 724-841-0044. They're in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex, right behind King's and Villa Grande Restaurants, just off Newcastle Road here in Butler. Gone Postal Butler your friendly neighborhood shipping center. We'll be right back.
When you want a home-cooked meal at a reasonable price, go to Michael's Restaurant. Featuring Italian and American cuisine, daily lunch and dinner specials, prime rib on Fridays and Saturdays, and homemade desserts. Open 7 days a week from 7 to 9, Michael's Restaurant on 422 near the Butler Fairgrounds.
In 2019, Tri-River celebrates 25 years as your Butler neighbor, providing exceptional musculoskeletal care in the community.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tom Mazzanegro, known by many as Dr. Muzzy, and I'm an orthopedic hip and knee surgeon. Patients do best when they are engaged with the process, educated, and invested in their own well-being. At Tri-Rivers, the patient is at the center of everything we do.
To learn more or to schedule an appointment, visit TriRiversMSK.com or call 1-866-
866-874-7483. Welcome back, good friends. We're talking with Chip Brunst. He's Information and Education Specialist for the Pennsylvania Game Commission. The number of hunters is dropping, unfortunately, isn't it? I can remember when I started in this business, every year the standard news release said an estimated 1 million hunters will be taking to the woods for the first day of deer season, you know, that Monday after Thanksgiving. This past year, I saw the estimate, it was 750,000.
That's correct.
750,000. That's down a lot.
Yes, that's correct. There's many different reasons for that. A lot of it is time. I would blame, and I'm guilty of this myself, allowing my own children to do it. Also, we've allowed their attentions to focus elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that those focuses are a lot of times on Xbox and PlayStation.
Yeah. I say it's sad because I was fortunate. I grew up in a very small town along the Allegheny River. There were woods all around our house. We lived on the edge of town. And, I mean, we played in the woods from the time we were, I don't know, 5-6 years old. You know,
right.
We built camps out there, and, you know, and then when you got a little bit older, you know, you got a 22 or, you know, maybe a 410 shotgun or something like that. And it was just part of the culture.
Right.
We had, in the school district, when I was a youth, the first day of buck season and the first day of doe season were both school holidays because if they didn't make it a holiday, nobody came.
Right. Yep.
Everybody was out hunting.
Right.
What a great life out in the woods, exercising, you know, enjoying nature.
Yep. I think just society has changed. Our attentions have focused elsewhere, and as my job as the information education supervisor for the region is to find those focuses on how to bring those people back.
Mm-hmm.
Doing things like this right here to try to capture their attention, and do programs in schools, do programs at fraternal organizations. That's my participation in it. We call it R3, recruitment, reactivation, or retention and reactivation.
We have youth mentoring programs now, too.
Yes,
you can take pretty young kids as long as they're supervised hunting.
That's correct. They have to have a mentored youth permit. It's not a hunting license. It's a mentored youth permit, and you can buy that at your issuing agent also. And if you're the first-time buyer for one of those permits with your youth, you have to take the Social Security card along with you to purchase that for the youth. And then when they turn 11 years old, they still have to take a hunter trapper education course before they can get their hunting license. If they're less than 7 years of age, when they buy that permit, they get the ability for them to go out and hunt with the parent, guardian, mm-hmm. somebody that's a licensed hunter who's carrying the gun with them, but they don't get a deer tag. Once they turn 7 years of age, then they may get a deer tag along with that, in which case then the adult does not have to loan them their deer tag, which is the only time that a deer tag is allowed to be lawfully loaned to somebody, is through the mentored permit system.
Do adults still have to take a hunter trapper education course before they can get a license?
If they're a first-time hunter or trapper. Now, the only exception to that is if they are an active duty military member or within 180 days of just being released from active duty, or if they had took a course in another state.
What if they haven't hunted for 15 years and then they decided they wanted to buy a license? Is that They still make them a first-time hunter?
Well, it would be recommended that you take a hunter-trapper education course, again, just to be refreshed, especially like on what's in the book here, the laws. But it is not a required by law for you to retake it.
Is it expensive to take that course?
No, it's free.
I thought it was.
Yep. Now, if adults may take the class online. 16 over 16 years of age may take the course online, in which case there is a fee for that, though.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, I forgot what I was going to ask you. I had a great question. It has slipped my mind. Just like that 14-point buck slips your mind whenever you're dreaming about it, and then it's gone.
Yep.
Whenever you're out in the woods. There has been a lot of scientific research. Let's talk about deer, for example. I can remember when I was a youth, everybody went up around Tynesta to go deer hunting. They had deer camps up there and all that stuff. From what I understand, that's not particularly great deer territory anymore.
Yeah.
And people are wondering why. And the Game Commission did a lot of studies on that.
Right. The deer populations were brought down in those areas on purpose. Dr. Gary Ault, who was our the Game Commission's bear biologist for many years, piloted a program which started out as a point restriction, basically, which was not designed to create bigger bucks. It was designed to create a balanced herd. And we were trying to balance the buck to doe ratio and also bring some of the numbers of deer down in places where there just simply wasn't enough food.
Mm-hmm.
If you drove through Forest County, you could see out into the woods, but if you were to get on a stepladder and get 10 feet up in the air, you could then you had plenty of brush, so to speak.
So the deer had eaten all the low-lying stuff.
Huh? Right, and that was not good for forest habitat, or wasn't good for the forest health. So the number of deer have to be brought down for the younger growth of forest to get their heads, the tree's head, above the deer's, so that the deer aren't you know, they're not eating on the young stuff. So that was the idea behind bringing the deer numbers down. And once the forest health then was allowed to rejuvenate, then the deer numbers can be brought back to a balanced population.
When your game wardens are out during hunting season, they can ask any hunter to see their license, is that right?
That is correct. Yep, and licenses are no longer required to be displayed on their back.
You used to have them in those cellophane things with a big pin in them. Pin them on the back of your hunting vest or whatever.
Right.
Don't have to do that anymore.
Don't have to do that anymore. You just have to have your hunting license with you. The hunting license looks totally different. If you haven't bought one recently, they look totally different. They're printed out on a computer. And you have to buy one every year. But, yeah, you can stick that hunting license in your wallet and carry that hunting license with you in your wallet at all times. Don't carry somebody else's with you, even mentored youth permits, unless that mentored youth is with you. Don't carry anybody else's licenses with you. But, yeah, stick that in your wallet and make sure that you have a valid form of photo ID with you when you're out hunting also.
One of the reasons why it's important to try to increase the number of hunters, well, for general purposes, it's for the good and welfare, but it also helps to fund the operation of the Game Commission, right?
That's correct. Buying a hunting license is probably about 50% of what the Game Commission lives on, so to speak. The Pennsylvania Game Commission is not funded by your state license or state tax dollars. So when you pay your state taxes every year on April 15th, the Game Commission receives none of those funds. We survive off of, and as does the Fish and Boat Commission, we survive off of the hunting license dollar. And that being said, the amount that the hunting license dollar costs affects how much the agency takes in every year.
Mm-hmm. What's a hunting license cost these days? Or does it vary from place to place?
No, it's in Pennsylvania, it's $19 plus the issuing agent fees, which takes it up to about $20.70.
When I was a kid, I told you I spent days in the woods. Never saw a bear, never dreamed about seeing a bear. Now, bear hunting is big in Pennsylvania.
Bear hunting, Pennsylvania is your number one state on this side of the Mississippi for Pennsylvania black bear. We have the most in any of the states on this side, and we have the most stable population, the most healthy population. There are states like just as close as West Virginia, where the average cubs born per sow is just 2.3 or 2.4, where ours is 2.9 to 3.
Wow.
We have a healthy habitat to support them right here. Also, the average size of our boars are much greater than all of our neighboring states and anything on the side
of
Mississippi.
Boar is a male bear?
That's correct.
Sow is a female?
Right. Same as, the same as pigs.
Pigs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Gosh, we're out of time. I can't believe it. You have to come back with us sometime, Chip. Would you do that?
Yeah, be glad to.
Yeah, I would really enjoy it because I have a lot more questions.
Yep. I live just hop, skip, and jump up the road.
Well, we'll do it, by gosh. Yeah. Nice to meet you here today.
It was a pleasure meeting you, too.
Yeah. And I know we still have a lot of hunters in this area and a lot of folks who just enjoy the outdoors and they appreciate what the Game Commission does. Even if they don't hunt.
Right. Most everybody that I talk to are good law-abiding citizens. Just every once in a while we got to arrest somebody. There are a few bad ones out there, but 99% of the people we talk to are good, decent law-abiding citizens. They're good people.
Chip Brunst, our guest, information and education specialist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission, and I do promise we'll have him back here. We'll talk some more at some future date.
Thank you, sir.
Thank our earlier guest as well, whom we talked to from Berlin, Germany, for goodness sakes, Daniel Schoenflug, talking about the end of World War I. That wraps our program for today. I'm Dave Malarkey. Hope to see you tomorrow for the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn at 12:30 in the afternoon.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.